Hello everyone, welcome to the International Business Podcast. If you work across time zones, borders and cultures, this is the show for you. I'm Leonardo, founder and host of the show, but let's make it simple and just call me Leo. I'm based in Shanghai and I'm accompanied by two co-hosts, Stefano, based in Paris, and Audrey from San Francisco. Coming up on today's episode.
And so I think that, you know, as a special forces officer, you're uniquely trained for one thing, but more importantly, perhaps, is the experience that you gain just working around the world. And when I was, you know, an active duty special forces officer, I worked in probably about 40 or 50 countries around the world. And I learned a very powerful message that day, and that was, you know, when you're in charge, go ahead and be in charge.
Lino is the Chief Executive Officer of Navisio Global. He is a retired U.S. Army Special Forces officer with over 20 years of global special operations, interagency and multinational experience. Throughout his public service career, Lino developed and demonstrated an ability to advise senior political and military leaders from around the world. You can find more details about the guest in the show notes. Now, enjoy this episode led by co-host Audrey.
Hi, Lino. I'm glad to have you on. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Audrey.
So we'll get started with a simple question. Why would you define yourself as an international professional?
Well, I have worked in the international arena really my entire adult life. And it started in the Army, and I kind of sought out opportunities to get me outside the borders of the United States and work on problems that were more directly a result of U.S. foreign policy. And so that has carried over into my post-service career also. So, you know, I'll spare you the long story, I suppose, but I left the Army in Belgium and I just stayed in Europe and ran Navisio Global from Belgium. Did that for a couple of years, and then I went back to government for a while, also working in international work, and then moved down to Guatemala and set up shop down here.
Wow. So you definitely have been all over. What makes a special forces officer uniquely positioned to excel in the international business sector?
Yeah, I think what a lot of people don't realize about the special forces community, which is a specific organization within the Department of Defense, but it's the U.S. Army Special Forces Regiment, also known as Green Berets. We have language training and an expectation that we will be able to live and work in a sort of a different cultural context than what most Americans are accustomed to. And so, you know, to the extent that we're trained in languages, some guys get really good at them. You know, I speak pretty good Spanish. I had some French for a while. And at one point in my career, I spoke pretty good Malay. And so I think that, you know, as a special forces officer, you're uniquely trained for one thing, but more importantly, perhaps, is the experience that you gain just working around the world. And when I was, you know, an active duty special forces officer, I worked in, probably about 40 or 50 countries around the world, Africa, the Middle East, all over Europe, all over Asia, even in Latin America a little bit. I think more important than the training that we get is the experience that comes along with solving the nation's problems overseas. And most of the time that's in partnership with somebody, not necessarily in conflict with somebody, but, there's a curiosity, I think, about other places and other cultures and other contexts that come along with that. And so to answer your question, a special forces officer is uniquely positioned to be an international operator, to be an international businessman, specifically because of that. And yeah, and I think that's borne out in my experience post-Army. You know, I've got connections all over the world, people that I enjoy pretty good relationships with in most cases, and people that I can count on to help me solve problems. And that's basically what I've attempted to do with Navisio Global.
Speaking of Navisio Global, your work with Navisio Global has ranged from Australia to Norway to Indonesia to Latin America. Can you name three common traits that you've witnessed when working across all those areas?
You know, and attention to detail is always going to be in demand. People expect you to do your job well, whatever it is, and they want you to be able to handle complex relationships and complex circumstances without missing anything that's really important. And that takes practice. It takes a bit of an attention to detail. And so that's probably the first thing. And I think that just goes along with the broader category of being a professional person. You've got to be trustworthy. And so it didn't matter whether I was, you know, helping develop a course for a university in Australia, or I was working on a NATO exercise, for example, in Norway, or helping someone get out of jail in Indonesia, the ability to approach problems in a professional way that consider the interests of organizations and individuals with influence, and the ability to marshal resources in order to solve those problems, that takes a professional approach. And so, you know, those are two traits: their attention to detail, a professional approach. And then I think the third one that I would probably consider the most important actually is an interest in relationships with people. Because at the end of the day, business is a relationship between two or more people. You know, there has to be some measure of trust. And whether that just comes from individual chemistry or some sort of contract mechanism or law or a combination thereof, it's those relationships that make things work. Because when things get difficult or the unexpected happens, we as human beings, I think, fall back on our relationships every single time.
Let's focus on ROI. Tell us what it is and what are some business strategies you implemented in Guatemala that you would do differently in another country?
Yeah, so ROI started life as a project of Navisio Global. We have a service, what we call establishment planning, and that's helping people set up businesses in places that they might not otherwise be able to set up a business. I've done this a couple of times in mostly minor circumstances, but ROI is a little different. ROI started as an idea that came to me from a friend that I had worked with in Colombia. He's an Air Force officer. His name's Phil. And Phil called me one day and he said, "Lino, in the Air Force, my job is to run around the world and teach our allies and partners how to integrate aircraft into their operations on the ground. And I don't see that anyone in Latin America is doing that for private security work." And he said, "Can we do it in Guatemala?" He knew that I was down here. And this was part of a larger conversation. But, you know, we put some thought into that. And I said, "Yeah, I think we can do that." And so ROI was born as an idea. Phil and I embarked on, you know, personal investment in order to get this thing off the ground. But it's grown beyond that now. And we are on the cusp of being operationally certified to fly drones commercially in Guatemala in a security context. So one of our primary tasks is providing the aerial component of a security presence for important individuals. We can do that also with fixed sites. We can do it for logistical chains, all of which are necessary services here in Central America. And no one else is doing that in the region. And the reason no one else is doing it is because it requires special training and experience to do that integration properly. And of course, some technology. But knowing how to put all that stuff together is very important. So going back to your question is, you know, what are some business strategies that we implemented in Guatemala that we'd probably do differently somewhere else? The answer goes back to culture. You know, we briefly talked about the importance of culture and that cultural curiosity of being a special forces officer a few minutes ago. But the culture in Latin America, the business culture, is different than it is elsewhere. Here in Central America, I'm very dependent and very cognizant of the power of familial relationships and word of mouth sort of communication. If I were to establish ROI in a place like Europe or the United States or, you know, certain other parts of the world in Asia, for example, my strategy for getting the word out and approaching investors and clients might look a lot more like a media campaign, whether that's social media or traditional media. In Central America, it's far more powerful for me to find people that can unlock doors to communities of interest that would have the resources and the interest in getting ROI off the ground, so to speak.
Noting those differences between cultural strategies, do you have a preference for working and doing business in a certain type of strategy-based country versus another?
I get asked a variation of that question a lot. What was your favorite place? Where would you go? You know, what did you enjoy the most about your travels? And, you know, I've worked in 40, 50, 70 different countries around the world. Having a preference is kind of like what do you prefer to eat today? You know, it changes with your mood. And, you know, I really enjoyed working and living and interacting with people in all different parts of the world. Really enjoyed it. One thing I would say that makes Latin America particularly nice for me is that my Spanish is quite good. So I'm able to get into a level of detail with both relationships and operations that, you know, I'd have trouble doing in Japan, for example. And so it does help me in that regard. I don't know that I would say Latin America or Central America is my favorite over a place like Malaysia, where I went to grad school, for example, or in places I worked all over Europe. It's different, you know, it's different. And I find great satisfaction and a lot of energy I derive from just figuring it out. Like how do people in, for example, the Netherlands interact with each other and do business and build trust? And how is that different from the way I have to do it when I'm working in Southeast Asia or in Latin America or fill in the blank, right?
This episode is sponsored by International Expansion Explained. Are you looking to expand internationally, but you're not sure where to start? Or you export already, but would like to venture further overseas? Reach out to arrange an International Clarity session and learn more about growth plans at katherinereed.com. That is katherinreed.com.
You're the president of the nonprofit Combat Diver Foundation. How has your global experience influenced your philanthropic work?
The Combat Diver Foundation, it started life as a very limited idea to help the U.S. Army preserve a specific artifact that was specific to an Army school in Key West, Florida. We call it the Special Forces Underwater Operations School. And it grew. So the concept grew beyond that. And it grew because as we started learning more and more about the history that we purported to preserve or want to preserve, we started realizing that it was that limiting ourselves to this one artifact from this one school was probably not the way to go. The history is so much broader and has so much more complex connections involved. And those connections go overseas and they go back in time, at least to the Second World War, but probably farther back than that, depending on how you want to tell the story. And so I think going back again to that cross-cultural comfort, that curiosity about others, that appreciation for sort of different approaches that come with different cultures and different languages and so forth, I think that allowed me to see value in bringing in people from all over the world, that the combat diver story is not limited to the one schoolhouse in Florida that it started with. But in fact, you know, it involves the allies. It involves nations that are not necessarily allies, but partners. It goes back to World War II, like I said. And, that a lot of people don't know this, but most of the early innovations in military diving tactics and technology started in Italy. So you almost can't tell the combat diver story without telling the Italian story. And I appreciated that. And again, you know, we go back to experience and culture and curiosity. I very much appreciated that story. And I worked with the Italian Special Forces guys, both Navy and Army. And you know, I felt very strongly that that had to be told. And so, you know, to answer your question there, that's how that global experience influenced that philanthropic work. And now we've got members in 11 countries around the world and growing pretty steadily. You know, we've got members on 3 or 4 different continents and 40 something U.S. states. And it's a really neat network to have because everybody's got a piece of the story to tell.
So as CDF expands, will it expand into Asia? And if so, what is the appeal that drives Asians towards membership or other forms of support?
Well, I certainly hope it will. You know, and I've talked to the Indonesians about it in particular because they have a very strong diving program, which, you know, sort of makes sense when you have an island nation of 17,000 islands or whatever it is. You know, but they're not the only ones that have a great military diving tradition or military maritime tradition. So it's we do hope the Asians will join us sooner rather than later. We don't yet have any Asian members in the CDF, but you know, there are Asian stories to be told, and there's a lot of capability in Asia in the combat diver context. And we'd be very happy to, you know, have them be a part of it and help us tell their story. Because I think to a lesser degree than the European story, or the Asian story is known to a lesser degree than the European story. And you know, the only one that can really help us address that are Asian members. So, you know, Japan, Korea, we know you've got great capability. We're waiting for you. Indonesia, Malaysia, same. You know, all those nations throughout Southeast Asia and East Asia in general have fantastic capabilities. And, you know, we'd like to be a part of it, or we'd like them to be a part of it. So to answer the second part of your question, what would draw the Asians to CDF? I think it's exactly that. I mean, it's being part of a larger community.
So, Lino, you managed a for-profit and a nonprofit organization. What are the main similarities between the two?
Well, I mean, look, they're both businesses, right? They really are. And so people can't forget that a nonprofit, although its motivation is not to profit, it does need to break even at a minimum. And that includes the programming that it spends money on. And so you can't waste money for sure, not in any business. But you know, you've got to do all the same, you've got to use all the same tools and apply the same disciplines to running a for-profit that you have to with a nonprofit. You've got to be imaginative in your marketing. Your mission has to be clear, or the service that you're providing has to be clear to people you're interested in, or that you want them to be interested in. And so in that respect, they're really not different. The difference comes in the motivation for making the money or collecting the money. You know, in a for-profit concern, you're trying to grow or you're trying to make money. And providing the service could be a value as well. It just kind of depends on what you're doing. But you know, your goal as a for-profit venture is to ultimately make money and grow your operation. In the not-for-profit world, you're still trying to make money, but the motivation there is to achieve some sort of public benefit. You know, you're trying to create a public benefit that you might not necessarily be focused on that with a for-profit firm. The other difference comes in, you know, how you make your money. You know, with a nonprofit, there's grants and that you're pursuing donors, and you're asking people to give money to you to achieve that public benefit. Whereas in a for-profit, they're receiving some service for it. But ultimately, at their foundations, the two are the same. They're businesses. They are organizations that need to run.
All right, Lino. I've got one final question we ask everyone who comes on the show, and I'm especially excited to ask you this. Tell us about one memorable moment from your international career. The most successful, the funniest, the most catastrophic, you pick.
Yeah. How much time you got, Audrey? I've been fortunate. I've had many, many memorable events in my career, both public and private. And but I think one that's probably interesting for your listeners here is the time that I met the Colombian Minister of Defense. And I'll try to give you the short version of this. It's a little bit more complicated than I'm going to make it. But I was in Colombia with as the aide to the commander of the NATO Special Operations headquarters. And some of you are asking yourselves, Colombia, NATO, what's that about? Well, the Colombians were at the time, and this was 2013, were seeking ways to expand their relationship with NATO, not necessarily becoming a NATO member state or anything like that, but they wanted to build some relationships. And they thought that the special operations arena was the best place to start that. And so they invited my commander to Bogota for a conference. And they, you know, we got there, it was a 4-day trip, and they rolled out the red carpet for us, and they showed us all of their capability and introduced us to all of their most talented leaders. And these are really impressive people. If you've ever worked with Colombians, they really, really impress with their ability to coordinate effort and organize authority. They're really good at that. And these the people that we encountered were fantastic. And so at their as part of this very last event was a meeting with the Minister of Defense himself, and we hadn't previously met him. And there we are in a big conference room in the Ministry of Defense in Bogota. And on one side of the table, you have our NATO delegation. It was a commander. It was myself sitting next to him. And then it was some colonels and a sergeant major from other allied nations within NATO, Spain being one of them. And on the other side of the table were all the commanders of the Colombian military. So the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, and then one other who sort of more junior general officer that was sitting there, and he later was the commander of all the Colombian military, very talented guy. And then the vice minister was sitting at one head of the table down at the far end, and the minister was late. So we were, you know, getting ready to have this meeting and then go catch our plane, and we're starting to get nervous because he's really late. And the vice minister would tell us every now and then, hey, he's coming. He really, really wants to see you, General. Please don't go. Just relax. Stay here. You know, don't worry. We'll get you to your plane, et cetera, et cetera. But the tension was just rising, and the general just wasn't really interested in making small talk with these amazing people across the table. He wasn't good at that. And I was trying, and it was just tense, right? Well, and so we're waiting for this guy, and I don't know what to expect, right? And at a certain point, someone comes out of the back room and they whisper in the vice minister's ear, and he kind of stiffens up and, you know, he kind of claps his hands and he said, okay, he's coming. He's in the building. The Minister of Defense of Colombia is running through the halls of this building to meet you, General. He's coming. Please don't go. And all the Colombian generals, very serious gentlemen who've been fighting the FARC their whole life at some great personal risk in most cases, you know, they stiffened up, and everybody just, you know, kind of prepared for this powerful and impressive person to enter the room. And I was sitting across from the door when it opened, and in walked a guy my age, and it was the Minister of Defense of Colombia, and I had never seen him before. And he walked in, and it turns out he's 3 years older than me, but this is a guy who could have been my college roommate.
Wow.
You know? And that was the first shock that I received. The second one was the command that the command that he wielded over everyone in that room. Again, very serious, respected people with power and influence of their own. And this relative youth walks in, and there was no doubt in anyone's mind in there who was in charge. It was him. And he was gracious, and he was talented, and he was engaging, and a very interesting guy. And I learned a very powerful message that day. And that was, you know, when you're in charge, go ahead and be in charge. I had heard that throughout my career in different contexts, but that really illustrated it to me in a very important way. I was very impressed by that. And, you know, there are times when you feel stress and you're under pressure to perform, whether that's in a business context or some other circumstance that you might be involved in. Sometimes you just have to take this situation. You have to take charge of the situation and own it, be in charge. And that sort of helped me operate at a pretty high level with my businesses. It helps the Combat Diver Foundation. it helps Navisio Global and it's going to help Arroweye. If you can present or create confidence in the people that you're trying to work with, it all goes back to those things we talked about at the beginning, the attention to detail, the professionalism, the interest in relationships, the curiosity about their culture and what they do, then you're going to be successful. People are going to trust you and they're going to believe in what you're bringing.
So Lino, before we go, who should connect with you? And tell us a bit more about your current role.
Well, I've got, as we've identified, I've got several roles. And so, you know, if you're looking to establish business overseas, especially a kind of business that sort of operates at the edge of foreign policy and international security, you probably need to talk to me. Because the way Navisio Global works is I tap into a global network of people that have amazing capabilities and contacts. And if I personally can't solve your problem in some country somewhere, I almost certainly know people who can. And I'll help you build the team and find the right solution. And I've done that a couple of times successfully. You know, in the context of Arroweye, well, anyone that needs security and or eyes in the sky in Central America and beyond can call us. Now, one of the things we aspire to do, I think once we get up and running, is we're probably going to have a team dedicated to fly away and go somewhere. And so, you know, the sky's the limit when it comes to drones. You know, you can provide security with them, which is one of the things we'll do. But you can also you can distribute logistics. You can conduct surveys. You can monitor crowds and frontiers or fix sites. And you can also protect people and material on the move. So call us. If you're the type of person that needs security, needs eyes in the sky, or needs to be able to survey large areas that are otherwise difficult to access, give us a ring.
Lino, I want to thank you for your insights. Thank you for joining us on the International Business Podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You can find the podcast on all the major platforms. Make sure to subscribe. Do not miss the weekly episodes. And are you an international professional? Connect with us on LinkedIn to come on the show. For now, cheers.